From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. The Democratic People's Republic of Korea, known in the West as North Korea, issued another warning to Washington, the strongest yet, against U.S. plans to conduct its largest military operations on the Korean Peninsula since the Korean War. This was a statement issued by an unnamed spokesperson for the DPRK's foreign ministry over the weekend.
If a war breaks out on the Korean Peninsula, the U.S. will be held accountable for igniting the war by mobilizing their massive strategic means and war hardware here, regardless of who mounted a preemptive attack. We have cutting-edge attack methods to beat up the U.S. mainland at any time and from anywhere. Also, we have diligently developed and deployed self-reliant weapons in the era of the Workers' Party of Korea, which enables us to fire strong artilleries.
The annual exercises, which have taken place since 2008, kick off on Monday and will run until April 30th. The exercise involves more than 300,000 South Korean and 15,000 U.S. troops, which simulates an invasion of the North with U.S. and South Korean troops conducting aerial, amphibious, and land-based operations for possible wartime missions. Pyongyang is also angry over a recent resolution by the UN Security Council imposing tougher sanctions. That resolution came in response to the North's recent nuclear test and satellite launch. Pyongyang said their actions were preemptive and aimed at deterring potential threats from the U.S. EU leaders were set to gather in Turkey Monday for a summit aiming to make it more difficult for asylum seekers to reach Europe. That meeting takes place amid turmoil inside Turkey, following a government raid on a leading opposition newspaper. According to Martin Schulz, the president of the European Parliament, relations between Brussels and Ankara are, quote, important and difficult, closed quote. Schulz said he told Turkey's Prime Minister Ahmet Davutoglu that freedom of the press is an important issue for the EU. Speeding up work on a joint EU-Turkey plan, inked between Brussels and Ankara last November, is also high on the agenda. The EU pledged 3 billion euros, or $3.3 billion, to support millions of refugees already in Turkey, as well as reviving long-stalled talks on lifting visa requirements for Turks and Ankara's bid to join the EU. But the president of the Czech Republic, Miloš Zeman, urged his European counterparts not to pay out the 3 billion euros, arguing that the money would be better spent in Greece, saying that Greece would take better care of the refugees and the money would help Athens repay its foreign debt. Analysts said that Monday's summit could be a turning point for Europe as it struggles to tackle a crisis that's on the brink of a humanitarian disaster. There are more than 2.7 million registered Syrian refugees in Turkey, according to the UNHCR estimates. On average, 2,500 people cross the Aegean Sea to Greece every day. Here in the U.S., a long weekend of the spectacle that is the 2016 presidential election, beginning with a Republican debate Thursday that sounded more like a junior high school locker room than a discussion of policy, to primaries and caucuses from Maine to Louisiana, topped off with a Democratic debate Sunday in Flint, Michigan. The media's wall-to-wall coverage still managed somehow to continue its months-long avoidance of almost any actual mention of public policy. After Thursday's kickoff of the weekend contests, we spoke with CPR's analyst Eric Dreitzer and African Studies professor Anthony Montero about the election and the situation facing the U.S. electorate via Skype Friday.
What I think is significant in all of this is really the sociological question, the rise of Trump, what this means. There's a political issue, I think, that is being totally ignored, not surprisingly, by the corporate media, and that is that this is basically the equivalent of inviting a dinner guest over for a dinner party and then realizing that he set fire to your house, because that's basically what Donald Trump has done. He seems to be bringing down the Republican Party as we know it. And this is actually being stated quite openly by the Washington Post, the New York Times, many others. And I think it's quite obvious, because if you actually look at what Trump is talking about, some of the issues, he's going against the conventional wisdom of what the Republican Party is about, while on the one hand, he's obviously playing to a overt racist element that is always at the sort of the core of the Republican Party, but it has been conveniently hidden from view. He has brought that out into the open. Simultaneously, I mean, he's taking some positions that, quite frankly, are to the left of Hillary Clinton when it comes to, you know, a number of issues. He's openly talking about the insanity of the evangelical crusade against Planned Parenthood. He's talking about, you know, certain things in regards to healthcare. None of this should be taken as progressive because it's not. But what it is going against the conventional wisdom of the Republican Party. And that is what I'm talking about here. He has essentially created a civil war inside of the Republican Party. From the perspective of those of us who exist outside of the established political apparatus, outside of the two dominant parties, which are in effect one oligarch corporate party with two wings, this is a good thing. We're watching the destruction of one party while the Democratic Party is in many ways also at war with itself between the progressive wing and the corporate wing. Now, I don't think that we're going to see the Democratic Party fracturing in the way the Republican Party has, but from those of us who want to see both parties destroyed, we have to be quite pleased.
What about you, Professor Montero?
Yeah, you know, it's very clear that as a personality on the political stage, Donald Trump is kind of an absurdist, cartoonish figure. But below the drama and theatrics that define Donald Trump is a movement of disaffected white, mainly working class and lower middle class, although not exclusively them, people who close to 40 years ago were seduced and brought into the Republican Party under the paradigm of the Southern strategy and then the Reagan Revolution, where they abandon any notion of class solidarity for race identity, and the whole discourse, be it on the religious or cultural wars or all of these issues of abortion, at the end of the day, and the subtext was white supremacy. So the very white working people, what came to be called Reagan Democrats, we could also have called them George Wallace Democrats, who abandoned class for whiteness and race supremacy, are now caught in a double crisis of both the white supremacist ideology and social system, which is unable to produce for them what the outcomes that they were told it would produce, and on the other side, which is not separate but interacts with it, a deepening crisis of the American economic neoliberal system. Now, this means that they are in open rebellion against the very elites that promised them that if you followed us down the path of whiteness and white supremacy and broke all relationships, even in unions, to black and brown and immigrants and women, let us say, if you took the path of whiteness, that you would be guaranteed a future. And that has all collapsed. And it is interesting because in a certain way, the logic was already embedded in the project, again, that goes back over close to 40 years now. It was already embedded there that whiteness could not resolve the crisis of capitalism. I think we are witnessing the end of the two-party duopoly. Donald Trump, if he does not know anything else, knows that he is leading a rebellion against the Republican Party elites in the name of the working class and poor white folk. They don't want to hear anything from Mitt Romney. They don't want to hear anything from anyone who has this well-crafted presence on the political stage of respectability, of whiteness, of white maleness. They don't want to hear any of that. And I think this rebellion has not just immediate consequences, but long-term consequences. And this is the last thing I would say. I think what is going on in the Republican Party is going to infect the Democratic primary season going forward. I think what we see, this boldness, this brashness, this I don't give a damn attitude that Trump brings to the political stage is going to be demanded of Bernie Sanders. Now, it's going to be difficult for him because he's not a reality TV personality. But the same type of intense rejection of the establishment is going, I think, to have a greater presence in the Democratic primaries going forward, because the same thing, the same objective factors driving the Trump movement are the same objective economic factors driving the Bernie Sanders thing. And Don, if I could just add one last thing,
sure.
Because the the absent, so to speak, factor in this whole project at this point is what will African Americans do? And I would suggest that the African American people as a group are still watching and looking and seeing how this drama among white people and the white masses in conflict with the white elite will play out. But I can guarantee you, black people will make their presence felt before this thing is over. They have not yet, in spite of what the bourgeois media is saying. Those southern primaries don't tell us very, very much because the turnouts are so small and the vote is so controlled. But I think when black people make their presence known, I think it will accelerate all of the processes of rebellion.
Yeah, you have at the bottom of all of this intense anger, a disaffection and a rejection of the structures, really, driving both of them. What do you think, Eric, going forward in terms of these, I don't know, like they're almost like the blob, these movements. They're so amorphous. But these movements that are forming, you know, sort of spontaneously, apparently spontaneously, because, of course, it's not likely that any of them are going to find the fullest expression of their sentiment if it materialized as something discernible by any of the candidates.
Well, look, I agree with a lot of what my dear friend Tony was saying. However, not to be the proverbial wet blanket in the conversation here, but I do believe that we may be overstating not only the level of courage of a Bernie Sanders, the level of ability to actually radicalize himself in terms of his rhetoric and ability to radicalize his own so-called movement. I don't see any objective evidence that that is happening. I think that he has had a number of opportunities to do that. I think it's quite clear that there have been irregularities, to say the least, in Iowa, irregularities in Nevada. He did not use his political apparatus to challenge either of those states. There was no legal inquiry funded by the Sanders campaign. There was no media blast by the Sanders people pointing out the irregularities, pointing out all of these things. That was done by a very small fragment of the so-called progressive press that really pushed those issues, and they're almost forgotten now. Without that, without Sanders having been able to show that level of tenacity there, I'm not seeing it in particular now that the blob of Donald Trump and the Trumpist, if I can say that without laughing, movement has reared its ugly head. Look, we know the power of the politics of fear in the United States. We know the power of what Donald Trump represents as far as white supremacy, as far as racism, or what I would call America's very unique form of fascism. That is ultimately what Donald Trump is mobilizing here, whether he knows that or not. This is your chances, you know, whether he is consciously doing this or simply riding the wave of what he sees as legitimate discontent, including the white supremacist movements and factions and so forth. The reality is, this is probably the greatest gift that Hillary Clinton could ever have received, because ultimately Hillary Clinton is so odious to her own party, so odious to her own, to the progressive base of the Democratic Party, if such a thing can be called the base, that it almost takes a Donald Trump to force the progressives to hold their nose and vote for Hillary Clinton. I can tell you in conversations I'm having with regular old liberals who have not totally broken ties with, to my own shame, they are voicing precisely that. They are saying, well, I hate Hillary Clinton, but I cannot allow Donald Trump to become president. That very obvious sort of conclusion and quite predictable conclusion is unfortunately the sort of wave that a Hillary Clinton could ride right into the Oval Office. Now, unfortunately, though, for Hillary at least, she is growing increasingly weaker as Donald Trump is growing increasingly stronger. And where 3 weeks ago, I think on Community Progressive Radio, I said that Hillary Clinton would stomp Donald Trump in a general election, I'm not so sure about that anymore. at this point now, I think it's actually probably the opposite. I think Donald Trump might actually defeat Hillary Clinton. But again, we have to come back to this question of the politics of fear. Now, Tony and I have spoken on numerous occasions about a variety of issues, including Martin Luther King. And Tony likes to cite, and I agree with him, this letter from a Montgomery jail from King. Birmingham jail, exactly. in which he warns against the white moderate. Okay, and the danger of the white moderate, or what we might call in today's lexicon, the liberal. And this is exactly what I think we need to be aware of now, that the white moderate or the liberal is going to be forced into a position of supplication to a system that they know is wrong, that they know is unjust, that they know is corrupt to the core, but that they will be able to justify it by presenting it as a vote against fascism, as a vote against white supremacy, as a vote against racism, when in fact Hillary Clinton represents all of those things just under the guise of the Democratic Party. I mean, if you look at the slaughter of Black Libyans, if you look at the slaughter going on in various parts of the world that Hillary Clinton is directly responsible for, including the news yesterday of the yet another assassination of an indigenous leader in Honduras, for which Hillary Clinton is directly implicated. All of these things, I think, tell us that liberals are going to be able to now hold their noses and vote for Hillary and justify it politically and morally to themselves by saying it's a vote against Trump. That is the danger, and unfortunately, I think that's where this is going.
Tony?
Yeah, I would look at it a bit differently and from a different angle. You see, what I see is something bigger than the 2016 election. And the rebellion of the disaffected, in particular, the disaffected white masses who had either followed, and really the majority had followed the white party, the Republican Party. And this is tens of millions of white working and lower middle class people over the last close to 40 years once again. Now in open rebellion against their elites and against their own political past. On the other side, among white working people who had followed their liberal elites, who were no less hegemonic and imperialistic and neoliberal and kowtowing even perhaps more to Wall Street than the Republican evangelicals. You have an open rebellion against them. Now, what is driving this? It is not Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders or Donald Trump. It is what many of us have still not gotten our heads around, the depth of the economic crisis. And people, even establishment economists, are admitting that the unemployment figures don't mean a damn thing, that real unemployment and underemployment in the nation approaches 17%, that 51% of American working people make under $30,000 a year, meaning that the majority of working class people in the United States are in poverty or close to poverty, that the system, not just the political superstructure, not just the party system, the system is in an existential crisis, a crisis far deeper than any of us recognize. Now, can Bernie Sanders or Donald Trump be the expression of that? Well, they can symbolize it. They can ride the wave of it. But the people who are rebelling don't yet have the language, the conceptual framework, the slogans, the methods of fighting that will be necessary. And that is where the left, the genuine left, is challenged to enter this at the level not of the elites, but at the level of the ordinary people. Let me just say that. Now, you know, let me just say one last thing. Concerning Martin Luther King, I think what Eric brings up is very, very important. And he was speaking from a Birmingham jail as a leader of a movement anchored in the South. And that is why when we read King and listen to King about the white moderate and now this unprincipled alliance between the white moderate and the black moderate and so on in the South, I think he is giving us a critique and an angle for understanding what is going on in these initial Southern primaries. I would not take the Southern experience and the Southern primaries as the framework for what's going to happen when we come to Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Ohio and New York going forward.
I agree. I agree. I want to stress something here, though, where I don't know that Tony and I are necessarily disagreeing, other than to say that I would phrase this slightly differently. While, yes, we do see a crisis of capitalism, there's no doubt about that. We see an economic crisis that is only deepening. All of the objective material indicators, from unemployment to infant mortality to poverty to hunger and all of these other things, all of them indicate the kind of crisis, long-term crisis, that the working class and the poor in particular have been facing. At the same time, though, we do have a historical parallels that we can look at, including, you know, just a couple of generations ago, and the danger that we face, of course, with somebody like a Hillary Clinton or a Donald Trump or a Bernie Sanders or whomever, is that whomever ultimately ends up in the White House, in whatever way they end up getting there, even if it's in a sort of serpentine, you know, fashion, that the objective conditions globally are such that there is no changing the course. And the course is, of course, and I certainly don't mean to sound too fatalistic here, but the course is one towards a very, very dark period in the world. If you look at the
could I just interrupt you, Eric, just quickly? I would just ask, what, you know, see, the United States is the largest economy in the world, with all of the contradictions that implies. Being the largest does not mean being the strongest. It does suggest being that economy where the contradictions between the people and the financial elite are probably the sharpest. I would just ask you the question, how do you factor in, or do you agree that we are looking at, in our very life world, systemic meltdown, and that this crisis of the political parties are but a symbolic reflection of a deeper systemic unraveling?
I would agree with that. However, I would take a 2008 as an interesting sort of let's call it a microcosm. What is the principal concept that emerges out of the economic crisis of 2008? The principal concept in my mind, which is now standard in our understanding and in the lexicon, and that is too big to fail. And I think that the United States, politically speaking and economically speaking, might fall under the rubric of too big to fail. And who is determining that it's too big to fail? It is the global economic ruling class. It is that transnational capitalist class, which does not reside within the borders of the United States exclusively, whose influence and whose interests extend all over the globe. They are the ones who are looking at these indicators. They're looking at everything from the collapse of global oil prices to the ongoing friction with Russia to the encirclement of China to all of these geopolitical machinations that are happening. And they're saying that if they are looking at a global economic meltdown, as Tony said, and I agree with him, that what is their alternative? How do they save themselves from that? Well, historically, the way that they have done it is with world war.
Yeah. And Eric, you know, and I listen to your commentary about geostrategic matters all the time, and I'm in agreement most of the time. However, you see, I don't think the period between World Wars One and Two fit exactly this moment in history, because that period was a period where the vast majority of humanity lived under one or another form of colonialism or semi-colonialism. There was no Chinese economy. There was no Chinese army and air force, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There was no alliance of China and Russia. If you remember, in the 1930s, it was a joint agreement between British and American imperialism and German fascism. If you go to the Soviet Union, there'll be no problem. Now, I think that with the collapse of the European Union, and, you know, we talk about the United States and China, but Europe is still the largest economy, if you take the European Union, in the world. That is in crisis. I don't think the ruling classes of the world, and there is not a single ruling class, the ruling classes of the world can find a common, united front to resolving the crisis of systemic meltdown.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.